Chapter 30. Roger Mortimer, the Queen's lover who escaped to France in the last chapter, was far from profiting by the examples he had had of the fate of favorites. Having, through the Queen's influence, come into possession of the estates of the two Despensers, he became extremely proud and ambitious, and sought to be the real ruler of England. The young king, who was crowned at 14 years of age with all the usual solemnities, resolved not to bear this, and soon pursued Mortimer to his ruin. The people themselves were not fond of Mortimer first, because he was a royal favorite. Secondly, because he was supposed to have helped to make a peace with Scotland which now took place, and in virtue of which the young king's sister Joan, only 7 years old, was promised in marriage to David, the son and heir of Robert Bruce, who was only 5 years old. The nobles hated Mortimer, because of his pride, riches, and power. They went so far as to take up arms against him, but were obliged to submit. The Earl of Kent, one of those who did so, but who afterwards went over to Mortimer and the Queen, was made an example of in the following cruel manner. He seems to have been anything but a wise old earl, and he was persuaded by the agents of the favorite and the Queen, that poor King Edward II was not really dead, and thus was betrayed into writing letters favoring his rightful claim to the throne. This was made out to be high treason, and he was tried, found guilty, and sentenced to be executed. They took the poor old lord outside the town of Winchester, and there kept him waiting some 3 or 4 hours until they could find somebody to cut off his head. At last, a convict said he would do it, if the government would pardon him in return, and they gave him the pardon. And at one blow he put the Earl of Kent out of his last suspense. While the Queen was in France, she had found a lovely and good young lady, named Philippa, who she thought would make an excellent wife for her son. The young king married this lady soon after he came to the throne, and her first child, Edward, Prince of Wales, afterwards became celebrated, as we shall presently see, under the famous title of Edward the Black Prince. The young king, thinking the time ripe for the downfall of Mortimer, took counsel with Lord Montacute how he should proceed. A parliament was going to be held at Nottingham, and that lord recommended that the favorite should be seized by night in Nottingham Castle, where he was sure to be. Now, this, like many other things, was more easily said than done, because, to guard against treachery, the great gates of the castle were locked every night, and the great keys were carried upstairs to the queen, who laid them under her own pillow. But the castle had a governor, and the governor, being Lord Montacute's friend, confided to him how he knew of a secret passage underground, hidden from observation by the weeds and brambles with which it was overgrown, and how, through that passage, the conspirators might enter in the dead of the night and go straight to Mortimer's room. Accordingly, upon a certain dark night, at midnight, they made their way through this dismal place, startling the rats and frightening the owls and bats, and came safely to the bottom of the main tower of the castle, where the king met them, and took them up a profoundly dark staircase in a deep silence. They soon heard the voice of Mortimer in council with some friends, and bursting into the room with a sudden noise, took him prisoner. The queen cried out from her bedchamber, "Oh, my sweet son, my dear son, spare my gentle Mortimer!" They carried him off, however, and, before the next parliament, accused him of having made differences between the young king and his mother, and of having brought about the death of the Earl of Kent, and even of the late king. For, as you know by this time, when they wanted to get rid of a man in those old days, they were not very particular of what they accused him. Mortimer was found guilty of all this, and was sentenced to be hanged at Tyburn. The king shut his mother up in genteel confinement, where she passed the rest of her life, and now he became king in earnest. The first effort he made was to conquer Scotland. The English lords who had lands in Scotland, finding that their rights were not respected under the late peace, made war on their own account, choosing for their general, Edward, the son of John Baliol, who made such a vigorous fight that in less than 2 months he won the whole Scottish kingdom. He was joined, when thus triumphant, by the king and parliament, and he and the king in person besieged the Scottish forces in Berwick. The whole Scottish army coming to the assistance of their countrymen, such a furious battle ensued, that 30,000 men are said to have been killed in it. Baliol was then crowned King of Scotland, doing homage to the King of England. But little came of his successes after all, for the Scottish men rose against him, within no very long time, and David Bruce came back within 10 years, and took his kingdom. France was a far richer country than Scotland, and the king had a much greater mind to conquer it. So, he let Scotland alone, and pretended that he had a claim to the French throne in right of his mother. He had, in reality, no claim at all, but that mattered little in those times. He brought over to his cause many little princes and sovereigns, and even courted the alliance of the people of Flanders, a busy, working community, who had very small respect for kings, and whose head man was a brewer. With such forces as he raised by these means, Edward invaded France, but he did little by that, except run into debt in carrying on the war to the extent of £300,000. The next year he did better, gaining a great sea fight in the harbor of Sluys. This success, however, was very short-lived, for the Flemings took fright at the siege of St. Omer and ran away, leaving their weapons and baggage behind them. Philip, the French king, coming up with his army, and Edward being very anxious to decide the war, proposed to settle the difference by single combat with him, or by a fight of 100 knights on each side. The French king said, he thanked him, but being very well as he was, he would rather not. So, after some skirmishing and talking, a short peace was made. It was soon broken by King Edward's favoring the cause of John, Earl of Montford, a French nobleman, who asserted a claim of his own against the French king, and offered to do homage to England for the crown of France, if he could obtain it through England's help. This French lord, himself, was soon defeated by the French king's son, and shut up in a tower in Paris, but his wife, a courageous and beautiful woman, who is said to have had the courage of a man, and the heart of a lion, assembled the people of Brittany, where she then was, and, showing them her infant son, made many pathetic entreaties to them not to desert her, and their young lord. They took fire at this appeal, and rallied round her in the strong castle of Hennepin. Here she was not only besieged without by the French under Charles de Blois, but was endangered within by a dreary old bishop, who was always representing to the people what horrors they must undergo if they were faithful first from famine, and afterwards from fire and sword. But this noble lady, whose heart never failed her, encouraged her soldiers by her own example, went from post to post like a great general, even mounted on horseback fully armed, and, issuing from the castle by a bypath, fell upon the French camp, set fire to the tents, and threw the whole force into disorder. This done, she got safely back to Hennepin again, and was received with loud shouts of joy by the defenders of the castle, who had given her up for lost. As they were now very short of provisions, however, and as they could not dine off enthusiasm, and as the old bishop was always saying, I told you what it would come to. They began to lose heart, and to talk of yielding the castle up. The brave countess retiring to an upper room and looking with great grief out to sea, where she expected relief from England, saw, at this very time, the English ships in the distance, and was relieved and rescued. Sir Walter Manning, the English commander, so admired her courage, that, being come into the castle with the English knights, and having made a feast there, he assaulted the French by way of dessert, and beat them off triumphantly. Then he and the knights came back to the castle with great joy, and the countess who had watched them from a high tower, thanked them with all her heart, and kissed them every one. This noble lady distinguished herself afterwards in a sea fight with the French off Guernsey, when she was on her way to England, to ask for more troops. Her great spirit roused another lady, the wife of another French lord, whom the French king very barbarously murdered, to distinguish herself scarcely less. The time was fast coming, however, when Edward, Prince of Wales, was to be the great star of this French and English war. It was in the month of July, in the year 1346, when the king embarked at Southampton for France, with an army of about 30,000 men in all, attended by the Prince of Wales, and by several of the chief nobles. He landed at La Hogue in Normandy, and, burning and destroying as he went, according to custom, advanced up the left bank of the River Seine, and fired the small towns even close to Paris. But, being watched from the right bank of the river by the French king and all his army, it came to this at last, that Edward found himself, on Saturday the 26th of August, 1346, on a rising ground behind the little French village of Crecy, face to face with the French king's force. And, although the French king had an enormous army in number more than eight times his, he there resolved to beat him or be beaten. The young prince, assisted by the Earl of Oxford and the Earl of Warwick, led the first division of the English army, two other great earls led the second, and the king, the third. When the morning dawned, the king received the sacrament, and heard prayers, and then, mounted on horseback with a white wand in his hand, rode from company to company, and rank to rank, cheering and encouraging both officers and men. Then the whole army breakfasted, each man sitting on the ground where he had stood, and then they remained quietly on the ground with their weapons ready. Up came the French king with all his great force. It was dark and angry weather, there was an eclipse of the sun, there was a thunderstorm, accompanied with tremendous rain, the frightened birds flew screaming above the soldiers' heads. A certain captain in the French army advised the French king, who was by no means cheerful, not to begin the battle until the morrow. The king, taking this advice, gave the word to halt. But, those behind not understanding it, or desiring to be foremost with the rest, came pressing on. The roads for a great distance were covered with this immense army, and with the common people from the villages, who were flourishing their rude weapons, and making a great noise. Owing to these circumstances, the French army advanced in the greatest confusion, every French lord doing what he liked with his own men, and putting out the men of every other French lord. Now, their king relied strongly upon a great body of crossbowmen from Genoa, and these he ordered to the front to begin the battle, on finding that he could not stop it. They shouted once, they shouted twice, they shouted three times, to alarm the English archers, but, the English would have heard them shout 3,000 times, and would have never moved. At last the crossbowmen went forward a little, and began to discharge their bolts, upon which, the English let fly such a hail of arrows, that the genisse speedily made off for their crossbows, besides being heavy to carry, required to be wound up with a handle, and consequently took time to reload. The English, on the other hand, could discharge their arrows almost as fast as the arrows could fly. When the French king saw the genisse turning, he cried out to his men to kill those scoundrels, who were doing harm instead of service. This increased the confusion. Meanwhile the English archers, continuing to shoot as fast as ever, shot down great numbers of the French soldiers and knights, whom certain sly Cornishmen and Welshmen, from the English army, creeping along the ground, dispatched with great knives. The prince and his division were at this time so hard pressed, that the Earl of Warwick sent a message to the king, who was overlooking the battle from a windmill, beseeching him to send more aid. "Is my son killed?" said the king. "No, sire, Please God, apostrophe return the messenger. Is he wounded? Apostrophe said the king. No, sire. Apostrophe, is he thrown to the ground? Apostrophe said the king. No, sire, not so, but he is very hard-pressed. Apostrophe said the king, go back to those who sent you, and tell them I shall send no aid, because I set my heart upon my son proving himself this day a brave knight, and because I am resolved, please God, that the honor of a great victory shall be his. Apostrophe, these bold words, being reported to the prince and his division, so raised their spirits, that they fought better than ever. The king of France charged gallantly with his men many times, but it was of no use. Night closing in, his horse was killed under him by an English arrow, and the knights and nobles who had clustered thick about him early in the day, were now completely scattered. At last, some of his few remaining followers led him off the field by force, since he would not retire of himself, and they journeyed away to Amiens. The victorious English, lighting their watchfires, made merry on the field, and the king, riding to meet his gallant son, took him in his arms, kissed him, and told him that he had acted nobly, and proved himself worthy of the day, and of the crown. While it was yet night, King Edward was hardly aware of the great victory he had gained. But, next day, it was discovered that 11 princes, 1,200 knights, and 30,000 common men lay dead upon the French side. Among these was the King of Bohemia, an old blind man, who, having been told that his son was wounded in the battle, and that no force could stand against the Black Prince, called to him two knights, put himself on horseback between them, fastened the three bridles together, and dashed in among the English, where he was presently slain. He bore as his crest three white ostrich feathers, with the motto Ichdien, signifying in English I serve. Apostrophe This crest and motto were taken by the Prince of Wales in remembrance of that famous day, and have been borne by the Prince of Wales ever since. 5 days after this great battle, the king laid siege to Calais. This siege ever afterwards memorable lasted nearly a year. In order to starve the inhabitants out, King Edward built so many wooden houses for the lodgings of his troops, that it is said their quarters looked like a second Calais suddenly sprung around the first. Early in the siege, the governor of the town drove out what he called the useless mouths, to the number of 1,700 persons, men, and women, young and old. King Edward allowed them to pass through his lines, and even fed them, and dismissed them with money. But, later in the siege, he was not so merciful. 500 more, who were afterwards driven out, dying of starvation and misery. The garrison were so hard pressed at last, that they sent a letter to King Philip, telling him that they had eaten all the horses, all the dogs, and all the rats and mice that could be found in the place, and that if he did not relieve them, they must either surrender to the English, or eat one another. Philip made one effort to give them relief, but they were so hemmed in by the English power that he could not succeed, and was fain to leave the place. Upon this they hoisted the English flag, and surrendered to King Edward. Tell your general, apostrophe said he to the humble messengers who came out of the town, that I require to have sent here 6 of the most distinguished citizens, bare-legged, and in their shirts, with ropes about their necks, and let those 6 men bring with them the keys of the castle and the town. Apostrophe, when the governor of Calais related this to the people in the marketplace, there was great weeping and distress, in the midst of which, one worthy citizen, named Eustace de Saint-Pierre, rose up and said, that if the 6 men required were not sacrificed, the whole population would be. Therefore, he offered himself as the first. Encouraged by this bright example, 5 other worthy citizens rose up one after another, and offered themselves to save the rest. The governor, who was too badly wounded to be able to walk, mounted a poor old horse that had not been eaten, and conducted these good men to the gate, while all the people cried, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.